Good afternoon, and joining us on the weekend is Gus Sanchez. Gus is the superintendent of the Thomas Isle National Memorial Park here in El Paso, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Thomas Isle, but we're also going to talk about the National Park Service because they're celebrating their 100th anniversary. Gus, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you, Louis, for inviting me.
And so I was talking about the fact that this is the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, and there have been some misconceptions about what the anniversary actually is or means. So if you wouldn't mind sharing that with us.
Yes, this is the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. We were established in 1916, and the agency was established. However, I think the confusion comes about because people understand that there were national parks before there was a National Park Service. For example, Yellowstone National Park was established in 1872, many years before the Park Service came along. And in those early years, actually talking about that teaches you a little bit about the history of the national parks, because during the interim period, before there was a National Park Service and there were National Park Service rangers, right, the United States Army was assigned to protect national parks. In most cases, at places like Yellowstone or Yosemite, one of those earlier parks, it would be African-American cavalry soldiers who were assigned to protect national park sites. And you can tell that if you look at the National Park Rangers uniform. You look at our uniform, gray shirt, dark green pants, right? We wear a dark green jacket when we're in dress uniform, and we wear the flat hat, the ranger hat, as people know it. Actually, guys that were in the military might look at it as the drill instructor's hat, and everybody who was in the military will remember that. But this is actually the campaign hat of the U.S. cavalry soldier in 1916, when the cavalry left those parks and the first rangers arrived to take over, right? They were a brand new federal agency and they had to decide what kind of uniform they were going to wear. And they actually took on the leftover uniforms from the cavalry soldiers that were left behind.
Now, the soldiers that who were there taking care of the park, you know, in the interim period, were they also wearing gray? Because, you know, I hate to be devil's advocate here, but people might say, well, gray was the Confederate. And so why are they wearing those kind of uniforms?
Well, you've got to remember the military changed from now, I should say they wore the blue uniforms in the late 1800s. And then it was in the early 1900s that they realized that they needed a color that fit in with nature a little better instead of standing out like they did in those blue uniforms. So by the time the Park Service came along, the cavalry soldiers were wearing the gray shirt and the green pants.
The situation, time period, you know, 1875, especially 10 years after the Civil War ended, after President Lincoln was assassinated, there were a lot of people migrating west, and the west was wild. It was the frontier. And I would imagine that would have been a difficult job for the military to control and patrol the national park, because some people might have, you know, not realized it was a national park.
Yeah, in fact, that was the real challenge, and it was a very tough job. You've got to remember the time period. Many of these black soldiers were former slaves, and now they were wearing the U.S. Military uniform. And you were trying to patrol huge natural areas, and that was the danger. So you got to understand their version of resource protection was you patrolled the boundaries of the park and you kept people out. You kept them out from hunting. You kept them out from mining, from farming, from affecting the resources. So I don't know. I guess you could think of it as the ultimate resource protection. But they had some creative ways. I mean, there weren't very many of them to guard a huge area. So I've read about some of those early soldiers at Yellowstone, for example, when they would have local sheep herders or sheep owners who would try to graze animals on the park, their ability, they only had the ability to eject them from the park. So they came up with techniques like to eject the owner of the livestock out one end of the park and take the livestock and eject them out the opposite end to where it'll take them that whole season to get back together so they can't come back into the park. So they had to be creative about getting the job done, and they had to adapt to the reality of the times.
A lot of people are familiar with President Theodore Roosevelt and the fact that he was an enthusiastic outdoorsman. Few people may know or not know the fact that he was a very sickly child, and he used, because of that, he started getting interested in nature, and apparently he had his first natural history museum in his room, and the lady who cleaned the house said that those needed to be moved out of there. But tell us a little bit about the role that President Roosevelt played in establishing park services and National Park Service.
Well, we were very fortunate that President Roosevelt was the president at that time. His own personal connection to nature and natural and wild places was an important part of the process. And I don't believe it would have happened right then if it hadn't been that he was the president. And so that's an important thing to remember. But there was a movement among people in the country who understood what was happening to valuable wild natural places. And they saw examples, for example, like Niagara Falls in the east. Incredible natural wonder. But in those early times, so many people started going there. The development around Niagara Falls, everybody started opening a shop, trying to sell something to the tourists. And pretty soon, the actual impression of the falls was gone. And that became a kind of a symbol of what was going to happen to every beautiful natural place in the West. And so there were a lot of people involved, but the two names I'd like to mention were not only President Theodore Roosevelt, but John Muir, who was also involved in the establishment of the early parks. In fact, John Muir was the one who would describe Yosemite Valley as a temple. And certainly I had the good fortune to serve at Yosemite for a little while during my career. And when I was there, I couldn't help but think about people like Muir and Roosevelt when they first went to these places and how remote they were and how wild they were at that time. And I think we're very fortunate that they were able to work through the entire system. And I think that it's not only that. It's that the national parks idea is an American idea. And many have written about it over the years. I know we had that National Parks documentary by Burns just a few years ago. But that idea that it's an idea born in democracy, okay, that the lands, the wild special places belong to all the people, not just to the wealthy, so that everybody can enjoy them in some way. And so it's an idea that was born in America out of our system. We've made it work. It's been exported to countries all over the world. And so I've had the good fortune in my career to work with my ability to speak both English and Spanish in Mexico, in South America, and help them. We're seen as the world leaders. Our agency is the world leaders in this business, and we're able to share that with other countries as well. So when you think about the early days of the Park Service, you've got to understand one other thing, too. Early on, the first national parks were wild, rugged places far away from populations. And so only a few people could go. Although the idea that they do belong to all the people, the economic ability of people to get there was not there except for the very wealthy. And so in the early days of the parks, they built these incredible lodges in some of the old major national parks like Yellowstone, like Yosemite, like the Grand Canyon. And you still see those today. But it was really after World War II, after the 1950s, when I guess more in general, everybody got a car and started to be able to travel with their family. And we saw this huge resurgence of interest in the national parks. And so, I mean, there's a lot that's happened in the history of the agency over the last 100 years. But I think today, you know, through every political cycle and every political viewpoint that's happened over our nation's history, not only was this idea born as an American idea, but it's managed to survive that way. People enjoy the national parks. People support the national parks. And, you know, and it's one interesting thing about it. We have now, in modern times, we're not just large wild rural parks, but in fact, there was a set of parks in the 1960s, you know. I was 5 years old when Lyndon Johnson became president of the United States. We all remember what day that was. Anyone who was alive that day will know where they were, okay? And President Kennedy was tragically assassinated. Lyndon Johnson became the president. But during the Johnson presidency, there was a huge expansion of the national park system to include other kinds of parks. We had originally natural wild parks, which we still have. Then a few years later, before in the early 1900s, we had what national military parks that had been part of the Department of Defense came over into the National Park Service. And so we began to get more involved in history. And then during the Johnson administration, they said one of the goals of the Great Society, Johnson's big program, was that national parks should be accessible to everyone, even urban dwellers that might not have the chance to travel to these places. And so like Chamizal National Memorial here in El Paso is one of those new kinds of parks.
And he was here, right?
Yes, yeah. And in fact, it would have been President Kennedy and President Lopez Mateos of Mexico ordered their ambassadors to settle the Chamizal dispute over the land. President Kennedy was assassinated. President Johnson was the one who actually finalized and signed the treaty that settled that land dispute and established the memorial. It did a lot more for El Paso, too, that we still enjoy. You know, the border highway, the new Bowie High School, improvements to Segundo Barrio. And so we're still enjoying the legacy of that. But what you see is that those new kinds of parks might not look like Yellowstone or Yosemite or Big Bend, where I started my career. Instead, they may be an urban park, but the idea of the national park is still here. And so we have three major types of national parks in our system. We have natural national parks, right? We have historic and cultural sites. Historical park. So a natural park would be like Yellowstone or Yosemite, right? Or Big Bend here in Texas. A historic site would be something like, I'll use parks where I worked during my career, like LBJ National Historical Park in Central Texas, or Little Bighorn Battlefield in Montana, where I got to serve as the acting superintendent. Historic sites that are really important to the fabric of the United States. And then there's cultural sites that you might remember that are strict, more cultural, like Mesa Verde in Colorado or Gila Cliff Dwellings here in New Mexico, where you have remnants of cultures that were here in the past. And so all of those three types of resources, natural resources, historic and cultural parks, right? And we try to protect all of them. The symbol of the National Park Service actually tells you that. The symbol we wear on our uniforms now is the shape of an arrowhead, right? And that's the arrowhead itself is supposed to represent the cultural and historic objects that we protect. You'll see it says National Park Service, and then you'll see the scenery, the mountain top, and the large sequoia tree. That's supposed to represent the natural resource that we protect. The bison at the bottom of the field represents the wildlife that we protect within the parks. And so our job, according to the Organic Act of 1916, says that it is our main responsibility, our mission, is to conserve the wildlife, the historic objects, the scenery and the historic objects within the parks, and to do it in such a manner that those resources are unimpaired for use by future generations.
So, like historical, getting into that category, mm-hmm. would places like the Lincoln Memorial and some of the other places in Washington, D.C., would mm-hmm. that be considered part of that?
Yes, it would be. So, exactly, the Lincoln Memorial is a national park site. We are the primary agency that is the federal officers who are assigned to protect the heritage, the legacy, the natural resources of the parks, the history and the historic and cultural objects of the parks.
We're visiting with Superintendent of the Chamizal National Memorial, Gus Sanchez. We're discussing the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service and also some of the other things that have been going on prior to that. Gus, if you wouldn't mind, before we started talking about this, I kind of kidded you that you were Ranger Smith, but I was the only one who understood that because Yogi Bear was a cartoon that I guess you and I grew up watching when we were kids. But you mentioned that Yogi Bear actually has caused some problems for some, not that Yogi Bear is a bad guy, but situations that people don't understand when they go to parks.
Well, I had the good fortune of serving at several natural national park sites. And I'll tell you what, I'm a kid from South Texas, from the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. I loved nature when I was a kid. I never dreamed that I'd get to do this, and so I'm a very lucky man. But when you work in a large natural place, a major part of our job is to help the public understand the significance of the place and the reality of what's going there. We are federal officers. There's laws, and we have to try to enforce them in different ways. But the whole point is, I learned this when I served at Big Bend, for example, for many years. We have the national park. We have our job, but it's nature that's in charge, okay? And so we try to also tell people, look, you have to adapt your thinking. And the reason I mentioned Yogi Bear and Ranger Smith was that I think sometimes in the absence of real knowledge and learning about interacting with nature, those kinds of ideas, those cartoons which we knew aren't really real, they become real for us. And so most of us don't have the experience of living in a really natural or wild place anymore, and we don't know how to behave or act there. And so going to camp, for example, in a national park or stay at a national park gives you the opportunity to learn that. But you have to go there in a receptive manner. So one of the things, for example, I talk about that causes major problems for wildlife in national parks is people's tendency and urge to want to feed animals. They're hungry. They can't feed for themselves, but we're not realizing wild animals have instincts that allow them to survive. They are not our pets. And so I've tried to teach this lesson, within my own family and make everybody understand. To really enjoy a wild species, what we need to do is enjoy them in their wild state. And they are not animals to be domesticated. And that's what the law says we have to do in the national park. So a good example of what can happen, I remember one from my career at Big Bend. I watched once people camping in the campground in tents, and you know how you zip them up? Well, I watched people that would leave food inside of tents, and the smell comes outside, right? And there was one incident that almost seemed comical. I'd tell people about it because I remember it very clearly. A guy was asleep in a tent. He had food in there, and a skunk came along and found the bottom of the zipper open a little bit, and he could smell food, and he forced his way into the tent. Now imagine, you're sleeping in there, now there's a skunk walking around, okay? Luckily, as scary as that seems, believe me, if you've ever been sprayed by a skunk, you're never going to forget it. It worked out okay. The skunk walked around, got to some chips or something, and then finally left. We can remember that as a comical story. But what happens is, what if it's not a skunk? What if it's a black bear? Now, it's a different level. The real danger from the wildlife to the visitor is real. And so when we have rules in a national park that says that the rangers try to enforce and say food has to be stored in the food storage lockers, you can't leave it in your tent, you can't leave food unattended, and certainly you shouldn't feed the animals, what you have to understand is that every single time you feed it, you are changing the behavior of that animal on a permanent basis. And some of those encounters can lead to legal ramifications, which can include a national park ranger, an officer sworn to protect the resources, having to intervene to the point of putting that animal down because he's been trained and taught to become a danger to human beings.
Which is what happened, what you said, with a baby bison.
Yes, I was just hearing about that recently, about a bison in Yellowstone in the winter picked up by somebody who thought that it was freezing. They took it to the ranger station. And unfortunately, once the human scent was on that baby animal, the mother rejected it, in which case the animal had to be put down. The consequences of us intervening with nature can be really serious. But this is, once again, an opportunity for you to learn. You can go to a park. So I encourage people, go to these places. We don't get to see places like this much anymore in our highly developed society. But that's why the parks have that purpose. You can learn those lessons about how important the park is and how our ancestors used to knew how to adapt to that in many cases. And in some cases, you'll learn the lesson that we didn't do a good job of doing it, but we have the chance to do it now. There's one other aspect of the parks that I want to make sure I mention to you, because I've experienced this as a long career employee of the National Park Service. People will ask me, you know, your job sounds great, and I'll tell them about all the wonderful things I've seen. But they ask me, what's really significant? I said, well, I'll tell you what's really important for me. Some of these places, I think back to the writings of Muir, for example, of John Muir, and the way he described Yosemite as a temple. These wild places can really have a great effect on your spirit. Okay, and I've seen over the years in my career thousands, hundreds of thousands of people looking for something. We live in cities. We live a very modern lifestyle. And we go back to these places looking sometimes even for something we don't know we're missing. But we can find it there. It's a kind of a relationship, an energetic agreement with nature. And I find that that's what many people come to national parks looking for, a kind of peace, a kind of reconnection with our ancestors and our roots, and to really understand how much our lives have changed and how that's still part of our legacy today. And so that's really important, I think, for Americans and why national parks continue to be sought out by people, not just from the United States, but from all over the world.
We are visiting with Gus Sanchez. Gus is the superintendent of the Chamizal National Memorial, and we're discussing national parks and the National Park Service, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Gus, some people may wonder, well, you talked about the fact that the Rangers took over the military, taking care of the parks, and so it sounds like a great job. What does it take to be a Ranger? And if you wouldn't mind kind of sharing with us, what's involved in the training, how do you apply, and what happens?
Well, in modern times, you know, when the Park Service first started, there were a group of officers who were called Rangers, and they had to do everything, okay? Everything from mending fences to maintenance work to learning about wildlife and interacting with the few visitors they had at the beginning. In the modern National Park Service, our work has become more sophisticated and more specialized. So today, if you go to a national park, you're going to find all kinds of employees there to sustain the operation. You know, just as important to our operation of, let's say, we have a staff of rangers, what are called protection rangers, visitor and resource protection rangers, and you would think of them like cops. They wear the same uniform, but you'll notice them because they wear defensive weapons just like a police officer, right? And they are fully trained law enforcement officers, but unlike a city cop, they have to know more than that because they don't just do people law enforcement. They also have to understand about protecting the laws, protecting natural resources and so forth, National Archaeological Protection Act, Resource Protection Act, for example. and wildlife protection laws and so forth. So it's a challenging job. And in many of the remote parks, they also will serve as the first responders, as EMS and firefighters for those situations. And so they are really the emergency response rangers. So it takes a lot of training to do that. And it's a very, very important and specialized job in the parks. But then if you go to a park, you will also go to the visitor center and you might meet an interpretive ranger there, also a national park ranger. But they're the experts on the resources of the park. And they might give you just simple information like what can we do while we're here. But a lot of them will lead the ranger talks and so forth that will help you connect to what's important about that park. These are complex places. I can tell you, I could have spent my entire career at Big Bend and never known it the way I really wanted to. It's that complicated a place. But it's wonderful. That's why people can keep coming back and learn more and more. And then we've got, nowadays, most of the maintenance work is done by maintenance employees, and they specialize in trails and roads and maintaining buildings. Some of that might seem like the outside world, but they often have to do it in situations that are very different, remote places, and they have to become very creative about getting that job done. And then we have administrative employees. Here at Chamizal, I also have specialized employees who operate the theater at Chamizal, which is different from other parks. We're the only one of the few national parks with a performing arts theater in it. There's only one other, and so it's unique. But it's a way that we use, one of the techniques we use to help tell the story at Chamizal National Memorial, which is a historical park, not an arts park.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because some people might say, well, I've lived here for a long time, and I've seen Chamizal National Memorial, but I didn't know it was a national park, and I didn't know we could go there and see things. I don't see any big trees. I don't see any deer. And as you mentioned, it's a historical park. So if you wouldn't mind briefly, we have about a couple minutes left. If you wouldn't mind telling us what people can experience at going to Chamizal.
Well, if you come to Chamizal nowadays, one of the things that we've been able to do is just recently we've done updated exhibits that really focus on the story of Chamizal and why it's such an important story, not just in U.S. and Mexican history, but in world history. The Treaty of Chamizal is one of the few times in world history where two nations who had a long dispute that ran almost 100 years were able to diplomatically communicate and settle that without actually going to war. Now, that's really significant, okay? And that's why this is a national park. So to commemorate that situation, they created the memorial. And so when you go to Chamizal, you'll see the exhibits now that tell you the story of how the two nations did that, the presidents that were involved. And so international history was made right here between El Paso and Juarez. That's really important for people to remember. We can teach you about that when you come to Chamizal. We also will focus on a lot of the stories, the history that has to do with the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico, the Mexican culture, the U.S. culture, the experience of Mexican Americans, all of those sub-themes that are related to our history you can learn about at Chamizal. And there's a lot more. So I encourage people, we have an annual program where we are showing different things and we're trying to tell those untold stories about that relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. We have big events, July the 4th, for example. We work with the city and we'll have the big Music Under the Star events here at Chamizal National Memorial. And so people recognize that. But we'll also have other historic presentations. So, for example, in the future, we'll have a presentation about the new book, the author of The Men of Company E, talking about the World War II vets from El Paso, a very important story in history. Now that story is coming to light into the national spotlight.
Well, Gus, thank you very much for being with us. We've been visiting with Gus Sanchez. He is the superintendent of the Chamizal National Memorial, discussing the Chamizal, but also the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. The Weekend is taped and produced at KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Andrea Granado. Our producers are Eddie Rosales and Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.